We're delighted to welcome two groups of students. We have homeschool students. Would they please stand? Good having you with us. Please be seated. And we have, is it Preble or Preble? Well, whoever you are. Preble High School students, would you please stand?
Very good.
Thank you. We're delighted to meet you too. These students are with us with a Court with Class program. It is a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from all over the state are invited to come and hear an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they are sent the briefs, and they have done work on the case that we're about to hear. For those of you who are not with the program, there are synopses of the case out in the foyer on the desk, and or if you prefer, raise your hand and the marshal will give you an outline of the arguments that you are about to hear. In addition to attending oral argument, the students meet with a justice after this argument, and they will go or may be joined by other high school students who came to the prior argument. Today, the presentation will be made by Justice Wilcox, who sits to my immediate right. And let me introduce the other members of the court. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. My immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. You've met Justice Wilcox. To his right is Justice Pat Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Rodensack. With these introductions made, I will now call the second case today on the November calendar is 03-1801, Amanda Carney Hayes versus Northwest Wisconsin Home Care, Inc. et al. Arguing for Northwest Wisconsin Home Care is Attorney Donald Schott. Mr. Schott.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson. Members of the court, it's my privilege and pleasure to be here today representing Kathy Avery, Jody Verbrack, and Cheryl Fontaine, the three nurses whose testimony is the subject matter of this dispute. I would like to begin by thanking the court for taking this interlocutory appeal to take the opportunity to address some important questions regarding the contours of the applicability of the privilege that this court recognized in the Ault versus Klein case about 5 years ago. I think there have been a number of issues raised by the briefs. I'd like to begin my argument by addressing two of the issues where I think there was some back and forth that may need some clarification. First of all, I want to make this point very clearly that the questions that are involved here, and the only questions that are involved here, are questions that I will refer to in a shorthand way as standard of care questions. I think there was some back and forth in the brief about asking about witnesses' thought processes and other things like that, but it is clear from the record. If you look at the deposition transcript of Jody Verbracken, there were 27 questions that she was asked to which we objected and instructed her not to answer, and every one of those questions specifically used the word standard of care. In the deposition of Ms. Fontaine, those 27 questions from the Verbracken deposition were incorporated by reference and again objected to. In addition, there were six additional questions that were asked of Ms. Fontaine. Five of those additional questions specifically used the words standard of care. There was one question.
Give us some examples.
An example would be, does the standard of care require for every patient that there be a written home health care plan? Does the standard of care require that the nurse sign the home health care plan? Does the standard of care require that a home health care plan address certain issues like respiratory therapy?
Counsel.
Do you have to be a nurse to testify to that?
I do not believe you have to be a nurse, and in fact, one of the plaintiff's experts that was named in this case was a physician who was involved in doing some training.
Well, why couldn't I, who was a filing clerk, was familiar with the home care plan, testify as to whether it did or didn't have that provision?
The question was not whether or not the home health care plan did or did not have this provision. The question is, does the standard of care require that? And that question, it calls for an opinion, not a fact. And that opinion calls for somebody's expertise. That opinion is, does a nurse exercising the degree of skill, care, and judgment that a reasonable nurse practicing in home health care would exercise under the same or similar circumstances, having due regard for the state of medical science at the time, be required to, for example, sign a home health care plan?
And did these people did any one of these people prepare the home care plan?
Ms. Verbracken prepared the home health care plan that was applicable to the patient in this case, Amanda Carney Hayes.
Were the questions relating to this particular patient's home care plan?
There were a number of questions relating to this particular patient's home health care plan, which were answered by the witness. And that really completes the thought that I wanted to make here, Your Honor, is that the objections were all to questions relating to the standard of care. All of these witnesses were also asked a large number of questions. All of these depositions went on for hours, and all of these witnesses answered a large number of questions that called for them to exercise their expertise, called for them to describe their thought processes. For example, Kathy Avery, who was the home health care nurse that was actually with the patient at the time that she had this episode that involved in the dispute we had here, was asked a number of questions about her observations, about her opinions with respect to the observations. A couple of examples of the kinds of questions that she was asked and allowed to answer were, for example, describe the nature of the secretions that were coming into the trach tube of this patient. What is a mucus plug? Can a mucus plug cause an obstruction of a trach tube? Did Amanda have a mucus plug?
Yes. Are those questions, since they weren't objected to, do you think those kinds of opinion questions are covered under the ALT privilege?
Yes, I do believe they are covered under the ALT privilege in the sense that the privilege applies because this is a witness who has specialized training and expertise who is being asked a question that requires them to use that special training and expertise to answer that question. However, if I may finish my response, the ALT test, the ALT privilege, is a broad but qualified privilege. And because it is a qualified privilege, it can be overcome by a showing of compelling need. And in this case, we took the position defending these nurses that, in fact, there was a compelling need that could be shown by the plaintiff to require these nurses to answer these types of questions.
Are you finished? I don't want to interrupt.
Okay. No, go ahead.
My ear heard, and that's why I asked the question, my ear heard your presentation to be very precise and very particular, that what we were here on today were only opinion questions regarding standard of care. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. One of the concerns that's voiced in the several writings with regard to the broader opinion and the compelling need is and showing is that it is so imprecise or subjective. It's not always clear if there's a compelling need. Articles suggest that it gives rise to ancillary, or they call satellite litigation, if you will, in terms of hearings. But is none of that the focus of our inquiry here today from your perspective, rather only the question of opinion evidence as to standard of care?
I think it is part of the analysis that this Court should look at. And for this reason, and forgive me if I'm just a little bit circuitous here, but I think that what this Court did in the Ault case, again, was to say we have a privilege. It is a broad privilege in the sense that it applies broadly, but it is a qualified privilege in that it can be overcome with a showing of compelling need. One of the issues that I think has been raised in the brief here is, in again, defining the contours of that privilege, should we attempt to define the contours of that privilege in what I would suggest is a very arbitrary way by saying, well, it will apply to treating physicians but not non-treating physicians. It will apply to parties but not non-parties. It will apply to people who may not be named as parties but whose conduct is in question because they are employed by an entity that is a party. And I think a much more sensible way to address all those issues with respect to the contours of this privilege is with the compelling need standard.
Aren't you then asking us to extend all?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think
Didn't Ault deal with a situation where parties, non-parties were being compelled to come in and testify?
In the Ault case, the doctor whose testimony was at issue was Dr. Acosta. Dr. Acosta was employed by an entity known as Women's Health Specialty or Women's Health Specialist, which was a named defendant in that action. So he, in that sense, was just in the same position that Nurse Verbracken and Nurse Fontaine are in this case.
But he's not in the same position as Ms. Avery, is that correct?
Not in the same position with respect to Ms. Avery, although there's a question whether Ms. Avery there is a question about whether a nurse can actually be sued, because a nurse is not a healthcare provider as that term is defined in Chapter 655, which I think further illustrates why this distinction between a party or a non-party is not a sensible way to use as a test for this Court to define the contours of the Ault privilege, why the compelling need standard is a much more sensible tool to use in making the decisions about where to extend this privilege or not. Is it a perfect tool in the sense that it will answer every question and not give rise to some questions about, well, when is there a compelling need and when is there not a compelling need? No, it's not a perfect tool. There will be lines that have to be drawn, although with respect to this particular case, coming back finally to a more direct answer to your question, Justice Bradley, I think it is very hard to imagine a situation where a standard of care question, where you can demonstrate a compelling need to have a particular witness answer a standard of care question. I think this in some ways relates to the types of issues that Justice Abrahamson was raising as well.
Before I let you go, though, one of the things that concerns me is, as I understand, in all, someone was brought in who was not already a witness in the case. With Avery, this is a witness who's already going to be on the stand. Does it make a lot of sense to not allow the other party to ask questions of a witness who's already there, already part of the action, already on the stand, particularly when they may be in the best position to know what happened in that case?
Yes, it does. Let me answer your question in two ways. First of all, in the Ault case, Dr. Acosta was there for a time period before the incident in question, just like Nurse Verbracken and Nurse Fontaine. He was involved in prenatal care of the woman that was the mother of the plaintiff in the Ault case. And he was asked and answered questions, and the Supreme Court made very clear, this Court made very clear in its opinion, that he would be required to answer questions, even opinion-type questions, relating to his care and treatment in that prenatal time period. The question that he was not forced to answer was a question that did not relate to anything that happened while he was in care of the patient.
Counsel, the Ault opinion appears at least in part to emphasize that Dr. Acosta was not named as a defendant in the case.
Right. It makes that observation. I fail to see anything about the analysis in the case that would make the distinction between Dr. Acosta not being named and being named as significant to the thought process or the decision of the court. But you're correct, he was not a party.
And part of the problem, however, is, arguably, is that it isn't just referenced parenthetically, but rather inserted in the statement of the issue and then appears later in the opinion also. I often would give more import to how to its use actually in and the statement of issue. But maybe I shouldn't in this case. Here it says, did Dr. Acosta, a non-party physician, have a legal privilege to refuse to answer it? We hold that under the circumstances presented, he did. Of what note is that statement of issue and answer, both with regard to under the circumstances and the non-party physician, if any?
I believe none, Your Honor, for this reason. If you look at the actual holding of the case, it does not repeat language that differentiates Dr. Acosta as a non-party as opposed to anything else. It talks about a witness having this privilege. And I believe if you look at the analysis of the case and where that privilege comes from, again, there's no reason to infer that a person's status as a party or a non-party ought to play a role in that. If I can amplify that answer and talk a little bit why about the reasons why I do not think it would be a wise decision on this Court's part to use the test of whether somebody is a party or not a party in defining the contours of the alt privilege, but rather instead the test that I believe the alt court used, which is this compelling need test. I think there are several reasons for that, beyond just the fact that I don't believe that was the rationale of Ault. If you look at other privileges that we recognize, the attorney-client privilege, the peace-penitent privilege, even the physician-patient privilege, that does not depend on the status of somebody as a party. If a witness is called and asked a question about a conversation that witness had with their lawyer or with their doctor or with their priest, it doesn't make any difference if that person is a party, an employee of a named party, or a witness that has no particular connection with any of the parties in the litigation, just a third-party witness. If they have the privilege, that privilege is something that they can assert. And I see no reason why this privilege should be treated differently, that their connection to the litigation may go into the compelling need analysis, but it ought not be the determining factor of whether or not the privilege applies to them or not.
Mr. Schott, last term, we decided a case called Burnett versus, Glenn versus Plant. Is that at all helpful for this court now, faced with the issues we have this morning?
I think it is very helpful, Your Honor, for this reason. I think that what the court did in the Glenn versus Plant case is to say that what we want to look at in making a determination of whether this privilege applies here is the substance of that testimony. There the case was, did it become a unique type situation? Was this witness have in a kind of a unique position because of some extrinsic factor, the procedural posture of that case where there had been a scheduling order that had not been complied with, and if this witness was not forced to testify with respect to some opinion questions, then the plaintiff might conceivably have been without any witness that would be able to carry the day for the plaintiff, and it would have a significant impact on the outcome of the litigation. And what this court said, that's not what we mean by unique. What we mean when we're talking about this privilege is to focus on the testimony itself and the nature of the testimony and the nature of that particular health care provider and their relation to the testimony.
How does that help us here?
Because, again, I think it supports the concept that what we ought to be looking at to determine the question of whether the privilege should be assertable here or not is the nature of the testimony and whether there's a compelling need for that testimony, not the nature of the party who's being asked to the entity, the person that's being asked to give that testimony, whether they are a party or a non-party, whether they are an employee of a party or not an employee of a party. I'd like to discuss, again, on this question of party versus non-party, in addition to the reasons I've already outlined, a couple of other reasons why I think that distinction doesn't make sense. First of all, if you look at the arguments that are being advanced by the other side as to why the privilege oughtn't apply here, it really comes down to we think we need this testimony. We think we can demonstrate a compelling need for the testimony. Well, if that's the rationale, then that ought to be the test. If that's really what we're looking at, that's what we ought to look at. But in addition to that, I think there are two policy reasons that this court needs to consider in terms of the practical impact of making the question of what type of discovery can be taken of a witness depend on their status as either a party or not a party. First of all, if someone's status as a party or not a party will determine how many questions you can ask them and what kind of questions you will ask them. It gives a great incentive to name additional people as defendants in lawsuit so that there will be an ability to ask them these types of questions. And
doesn't our – I read that argument, and what I wrote in the margins is you're asserting that a frivolous lawsuit would be commenced in order to be able to ask questions of someone. That's the way that I read your argument, and I just don't know if that's going to
– Well, I think –
frivolous sanctions that would impede that floodgate from opening, it seems to me.
There obviously is that check on in terms of there being a frivolous claim and an ability to show a frivolous claim, but I think you mentioned earlier the concern about all sorts of subsequent litigation and satellite litigation. I think this would be an area where that would be ripe for that to happen if people were named as party defendants. Oftentimes there is not a lot of information that is known just from the medical records at the time that a plaintiff commences a lawsuit, and there will be a great incentive, as I mentioned, to name people that are marginally involved on a theory. Well, they may have played some role in this.
But doesn't Jarnes take care of that?
Well, Jarnes talks about at a certain time after the litigation has been commenced, once you are in possession of certain knowledge. Once you are in possession of certain knowledge, I think another whole area where this will come into play is there will be a great incentive to want to litigate that question of whether Dr. X has been appropriately named in the lawsuit or not before any discovery is taken of Dr. X. And so you will create, I think, a lot of satellite litigation with respect to that. Another aspect of this, which I think is demonstrated by this case, is if you look at one of the arguments that's being made in this case with respect to the two nurses whose names do not appear in the complaint, Jody Verbrack and Cheryl Fontaine, is that, well, their conduct is somehow at issue. If you look at the complaint in this case, it is a very bare-bones complaint. It names who the parties are. It's the first document in the record, I believe. Names who the parties are. It says that on such and such a date, Amanda Carney Hayes suffered some injuries, and then it says she suffered those injuries because of the negligence of Northwest Healthcare, its agents, its employees, and or Kathy Avery. You cannot read that complaint and have any idea that there is any claim that Jody Verbracken did anything wrong in drafting the home health care plan. You cannot read that complaint and have any idea that there's a claim that Cheryl Fontaine did anything wrong in respect to training Kathy Avery before she became a service provider in this case. I think that complaint is satisfactory to meet the requirements of drafting complaints under our liberal pleading rules in Wisconsin. I'm not alleging that there's anything wrong with that complaint. But how are we to know, based on that complaint, whether or not these kinds of questions are appropriate or not? That would be another whole area of satellite litigation. Well, what do you mean by, why can you ask this question of that witness? What do you mean by this allegation of your complaint? If you make the distinction hinge on what I think is a rather arbitrary distinction, whether somebody has been named or not named, whether somebody's conduct has been noticed to be in question or not. I think a much more sensible test is the compelling need test. And I think it worked well here. Again, if you go back and look at the depositions that were taken in this case, I think the plaintiff had ample opportunity to find out all of the information that these witnesses had about the events that occurred in this lawsuit, all of the thought process that went into their decision-making and their actions. It's hard to imagine any type of information that could be argued was withheld because of any of these objections that is unique to these witnesses. Look at the 33 questions that were objected to, and it is, I think, impossible to make the argument that any of these three witnesses are better qualified to answer those questions than the nurse that was hired by the plaintiffs to be an expert witness or the doctor that was hired by the plaintiffs to be an expert witness to opine on the standard of care.
Well, what about the fact that, at least with Nurse Avery, she was there. This involves her conduct. If you look at the statute on relevant defining relevant evidence, obviously this would be relevant in the sense that it would be helpful to a fact finder to get her opinion on that. She's involved in the treatment. Why? I guess I'm concerned about reading a privilege in such a way as to keep relevant evidence away from a jury.
Well, and that's where, again, I think it's very important to keep in mind what we're talking about here is opinion testimony about the standard of care. What would a reasonable nurse in the same or similar circumstances do in a certain situation?
But that's not what you're talking about, because you're defining the alt privilege much more broadly than that. So maybe the facts are here with regard to standard of care. But in answer to my earlier question, you said no, that it was much more broad than that. So it leaves me in a real gray area.
Perhaps I either misspoke or didn't make myself clear. I think the alt privilege applies in the sense that it is a broad privilege and applies. Then you look at the compelling need standard.
Yeah, for instance, you said that it applies to all opinion testimony, not just standard of care. That's what
you're
focusing on.
Yes. And it applies in the sense of all these questions that we allowed the witnesses to answer, it applied to those questions, but it couldn't be asserted because the plaintiff was able to overcome the privilege through a showing of compelling need. That is the distinction I'm trying to make, Your Honor. And I think that satisfies, I believe, the concerns that Justice Butler is raising about wanting to get relevant evidence from these witnesses. They were there. They do have information that is unique to them. They saw things that nobody else saw. They made judgments that nobody else made. And they should be forced to testify about that. And we're not contesting that.
Why shouldn't they be allowed to give their opinion?
It's not a question of whether they should be allowed to. It's a question of whether they should be forced to against their will. And the reason they shouldn't be is because they have a privilege, and there is no showing that that privilege has been overcome because there is a compelling need on the part of the...
Your position is that, doctor, did you see Mrs. Smith? Yes, I did. And when she came in, how did she look? She looked sick. That's an opinion, right?
Yes.
Okay. So under your interpretation of Alt versus Klein, that is privileged. And then I'd say, and then, doctor, what'd you do? I took her temperature. And why'd you do that? Well, I wanted to see if she had a fever. All of that, under your definition of the privilege of Alt versus Klein, is potentially objectionable because it is covered under the privilege and only is admissible. Why did you take her temperature? I thought she might have a fever. How did she look? She looked sick. All of that you're saying is covered under the alt privilege. Am I correct?
Yes. But it could be overcome with a showing of compelling need. And I think under those circumstances, assuming the patient's condition at the time she came to see the doctor is an issue in the lawsuit, all those situations there would be a compelling need shown.
That's the satellite litigation that occurs because of alt, because if there's an objection, then the plaintiff has to show compelling circumstances.
Well, it didn't occur in this case.
No, it did not, but that's the result. Justice Brasser.
Why shouldn't a health care provider who actually does some things be able to be asked how their own conduct related to the standard of care?
In addition to some of the reasons I've outlined before, another reason that I would give in answer to that is there may be many instances where a healthcare provider may not have an opinion as to what the standard of care is. If you ask these three nurses, what do? They know what they do. If you ask them, why did they do what they did? They know that. If you ask them, what do other people do out there? What is the standard of care that reasonable healthcare nurses do across this country? What is the reason to suspect that they know that? But if you're allowed to ask them that question, then on the defense side, we're put in a very interesting position. Do we decide we want to have our witnesses say they don't know what the standard of care is and then risk that being misinterpreted by a jury? Or do we have to then prepare all of our witnesses on what is the standard of care on a whole number of issues that they might be asked about, and all the follow-up questions. If she says, yeah, I think the standard of care is this, well, what makes you say that? Are you aware of this regulation? Are you aware of this practice at this nursing institution? Are you aware of this piece of information? It gets into many collateral things, and there is no need for it. If the question is, what is the standard of care, there are lots of people that can answer that question. I've run over my time. I'd be happy to continue, but...
Well, you will have an opportunity to continue in rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sir, is it Biegert? representing the plaintiffs here.
Thank you, Justices. Mr. Schaaf, it's been 5 years since the Ault decision came down, and it's become clear that the privilege identified in that decision has had the effect of blocking legitimate inquiry of witnesses. As an example of how far it's gone, just look at this case. In the brief, Ms. Avery asserts that she followed Amanda's health care plan and acted appropriately and successfully. In her pleadings, she asserts that she's not negligent. Yet despite this assertion, Mr. Schott tells me that I can't turn to her and say, Ms. Avery, you stated you acted appropriately. I'd like to ask you a few questions about that. Under the interpretation of Ault that's being advanced here, that's an improper question.
I don't think that's what he said, Counselor. I think he said that as an initial matter on opinion questions of an expert witness, the privilege arises, but whether it really is asserted depends, and whether it lies depends on whether there's a compelling need. And apparently in this case, you were allowed to ask what the nurses saw, what they thought when they saw it, what they did in response to their thoughts. Now, those are all expert opinions, but there was never a problem with your getting testimony about that, correct?
There was a limited area of opinion testimony that was provided to us in response to the questions.
Are there any questions aside from questions that require an answer to the standard of care that you were not permitted to ask?
There were none. However, we don't know what follow-up questions or standard of care questions would have led to. So in some respects, it's hard to say. But, no, the questions that are at issue are standard of care questions.
So you're basically asking the court to either make an exception or overturn the case Glenn versus Plant that we wrote last year? And
what I would ask this court to do is to overrule Ault. If the court is not willing to do that, I would ask the court to make a ruling that Ault does not apply to parties or to a party's employees or agents. If the court is unwilling to do that, I want the court to find the compelling circumstances exist in this case.
Mr. Beeger, I want to ask you what you may find to be a difficult question. But assume for purposes of the question that I were to agree with your contention that the Ault privilege was based on a false premise and should be overruled. Other than having a new justice appointed to this court who might share that view, what is it about this case that would require us to abandon stare decisis and our rule relatively recently created within the past 5 years and followed last year, abandon that rule here today?
And I think the reason is the problems that Ault is creating in the real world, and I'll address some of those. And I think a good example is what this court did in the Employers Insurance versus Johnson Controls, where it made a ruling on landfill cleanup and insurance coverage, and it had the unanticipated effect of creating massive litigation, massive confusion, and the court ultimately determined that even though it was a relatively recent ruling, it needed to be revisited because of the problems it had caused. And I think that's the same reason that the court needs to revisit Ault. Let me talk about the two big misconceptions about Ault that I think are causing the problems. At first, when Ault came out, I don't do a whole lot of medical malpractice litigation. It wasn't a concern to me. But as I see where Ault is going, it's causing me significant concerns. And let me just tell you a few examples of where the Ault privilege could be asserted outside the context of medical negligence litigation. Because the Ault rule, although we're talking about medical negligence cases, and that's what this case is about in many of the cases where it's been addressed, that isn't the only place it applies. In a motor vehicle accident, can I ask a truck driver if he was operating his rig safely, what he should do when he starts jackknifing? Can I ask a security guard at a mall if it was appropriate for him to put a teenage shoplifter in a chokehold? Can I ask that to their boss? Can I ask a farmer if his livestock were healthy when he sold it? Every single construction and remodeling case, you ask the subcontractors or the general contractor, did you do the work according to plan and did you do the work in a workmanlike fashion? Can I ask those questions? Can I ask a design engineer in a products case? Tell me what safety factors you consider when you engineer a product.
Mr. Biegert, has this court or the Court of Appeals, any of the districts, made any rulings that would indicate you couldn't ask those questions?
Yes, they made the ruling in Ault, and the ruling in Ault indicates
they did or we did.
You did.
And we indicated that you couldn't ask those kind of questions?
You indicated in Ault. Ault, the legal underpinnings of Ault have nothing to do with the medical malpractice chapter. They have nothing to do with medical malpractice law. The underpinnings come from a portion of the evidentiary statutes which state that a court cannot compel a person to act as an expert witness. And this court then extrapolated that to say a litigant also should not compel somebody to be able to act as an expert witness.
Well, I'm going to ask the question somewhat differently. Are the trial court rulings so holding that Ault means parties that are being sued or agents of parties that you can't ask these questions?
What I am hearing is anecdotally these things are being raised. I am not aware of any court decisions ruling on that. I would say Ault on its face says if a person has expertise and if they're being asked an opinion question, there is a privilege.
Counsel,
it is up to the good graces of counsel whether they assert the privilege. My remedy is to begin litigation.
This is your example, your prime example, that here the defendant is asserting the Ault privilege and then saying under these circumstances these particular questions are compelling, come under the compelling circumstance. But your opponent is arguing Ault means parties and their agents are covered by the Ault privilege. Right? And then, I mean, this is the very case that so states. It's just that at least some of the questions they have been willing to allow to go through.
They are certainly taking the position that Ault applies to parties. That is not the position that we're taking. Okay. We disagree with the Ault decision because of some of the practical effects it's having. If the court decides that Ault should exist out there and that the rationale still stands, then we would ask the court to limit it to non-parties.
I'm sorry, but do we have a list of the 33 questions?
We have. I know the questions with respect to Ms. Fontaine are in the briefing. Ms. Verbrocken, I'm not sure they're in the briefing. I would assume they're somewhere in the record.
Okay.
Let me
suggest to counsel that when there are particular questions that are before the court, that there is objection to that a list be provided.
And again, I believe that that is in the briefing. I believe with respect to Ms. Verbrocken.
Yes, there are some in the briefing. I didn't see 33 outlined. But go ahead. Continue on.
The problem, Your Honor, is, again, as I've outlined, is that it arises in a number of contexts. It also can arise in the context of defense asking a question. It would be within the Ault privilege for us to instruct our friendly local neighborhood chiropractor that he doesn't have to give defense attorney any opinions relating to his former treatment of the patient before the accident, what diagnosis he may have reached, what opinions he may have as to cause. We can tell him that he has an Ault privilege not to tell the defense attorney any of that information if he's a prior treating provider. Potentially in a products case, we could have our plaintiff who was injured on a punch press and ask, can you tell me, were you operating that punch press safely in accordance with the guidelines, and not answer that question because that's something that requires his expertise in operating the machine. What we're asking is that you consider these before the law is so firmly established and there's so much litigation on all of the expert testimony that's potentially barred by this. And not really expert testimony, just opinions offered by people who were involved in the underlying incident, that it becomes an even bigger problem than it looks like it is at this point.
Counselor, is there anything unique about any opinion question that you asked and was not answered? And by unique, I mean such that someone else could not have given the answer to that question?
There was nothing unique about the answer. There was a unique thing about the person who was being questioned. One, those persons had actual involvement in the treatment.
But the answer to the question, what was the standard of care to do A or to do B, could be given by another witness.
The answer could be given by a lot of witnesses, but they answer could not be given by another witness who was actually there. An answer could not be given by another witness whose conduct was being called into question.
Does the standard of care in a medical malpractice require that the expert testifying to it was someone who was there at the time of malpractice?
No, it doesn't.
Is there any case law anywhere in any state that you found that says that that's a requirement to give an opinion on standard of care?
No, it isn't.
Are those cases successful when they come before a jury if you have someone that gives an opinion on the standard of care and that's placed before the jury?
Not as frequently. When you have a paid expert giving an opinion as a standard of care, I would say that they're less frequently successful than
have you ever had experience with treating physician giving an opinion on a standard of care before a jury?
I certainly have.
Okay. And it was a treating physician who gave an opinion that the standard of care for this particular patient was X and I violated this standard.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, you said you had a treating physician. I guess what my question goes to, is it a treating physician who was involved in the care that was considered to be below that standard of care?
I cannot recall a case where a treating physician came forward and said my conduct was below the standard of care.
But that's what you want to ask these folks, correct?
I do, and I tell you that I expect that in 95% of these cases, what I expect the answer to be, as Mr. Schott indicated, is, you know, in order to render an opinion, I'd really have to look at some materials, I'd have to read transcripts, I'd have to go back and examine all the medical records, and I haven't done that, and I really have no opinion as to standard of care. That's what I expect I will get in most cases, asking these types of questions.
Don't you think that might confuse a jury who thinks that a nurse ought to know what the standard of care is before she renders treatment?
Well, I think we can argue about whether a nurse ought to know what the standard of care is. Certainly, she's competent to express an opinion as to standard of care if she has one. Now, she may not have an opinion as to specific procedures, and she is free to say, I don't have an opinion on that.
But the question about the standard of care, which is a requirement in medical malpractice, is not precluded from presentation to the jury by any of the objections made here, correct?
It's not precluded. And, for example, you could say, Mr. Biegert, we're not going to have that doctor testify as to his opinion because we know there's a professor out in Berkeley that you can go pay $2,000 an hour for and get her standard care opinion. Somebody else can render that opinion, so it's not compelling. What we're saying is that even under the compelling circumstance case, the fact that there is a hired gun out there that you can go somewhere else who has no involvement in the case and you can pay significant dollars to, the fact that they exist doesn't make the testimony of the witness who was there, who saw everything, who had knowledge.
Is there anything in the record that shows that the witness you had lined up to testify as an expert here charges $2,000 an hour?
I don't think it's relevant. It's certainly you're going to
I mean, you raised it to me. I mean, frankly, if I were looking at a compelling need and I had a plaintiff's lawyer telling me there is only one person who can testify to this besides the treating physician, and that person lives in Siam, and we can't afford to bring him in because it's going to cost me X dollars, that would probably affect my analysis of what's a compelling need. But when you've got a nurse that's set up to testify, and then you tell me, well, $2,000 an hour, I mean, if that's what it costs, I think that's a factor, but didn't think that was in the record.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, in respect to your questions, is that the argument that's being asserted by the defense is that the only thing that matters is whether you can procure that opinion somewhere else from somebody, regardless of what that other person's qualifications were.
I don't think that's what he said. I think what he said is if you have a compelling need, but I don't think this court nor counsel has outlined the parameters of what a compelling need might be.
And I believe a compelling need, and let me address that.
Good.
Let me talk about, just briefly, two other problems. One is the satellite litigation. And the satellite litigation is a problem here because what you do is you have these depositions. You have, according to Glenn now, specific questions have to be asked and the privilege asserted. Then it has to go before a court. One thing that does, again, is take up court time. The second thing it does is they have all the questions in advance of the time for testimony and can review them. But the third thing is then, assuming that they're allowed to answer questions, nobody other than maybe a first-year lawyer conducts an examination by reading a list of questions. It's more organic than that. The answer to one question leads to other questions. So the certainly it's very possible that when they answer some of the questions they were compelled to answer, that there are going to be other questions. So you run into perhaps significant litigation on what they're going to have to answer, multiple depositions, where pre-alt, you had somebody who was able to come forward and say, this is unduly burdensome, I'm moving to quash the notice of depositions, I'm moving to quash the subpoena, I'm using it prophylactically, I don't have to go through every question and every objection.
Counselor, in that satellite litigation as you describe it?
It resulted in one deposition, and it also resulted in...
Didn't it also result in motions in limine in front of the trial court? How is this different from the situation that exists prior to ALT?
It's different because it's not resolved prior to their testimony. Their testimony starts, stops, it goes to litigation, you start up their testimony again, hopefully you complete their testimony, but there's a possibility for further. You don't have the issues resolved prior to their testimony.
Don't you oftentimes have the ALT privilege asserted, and then counsel will say, go ahead and answer the question, and we'll let the judge ultimately decide whether or not this is or is not covered under ALT?
At the good graces of counsel, they may do that. There's certainly nothing in the law that requires them to do that.
Isn't that often done, Mr. Biegert? Isn't that the way it's normally done?
It wasn't done in this case.
No, and only in regard to the standard of care, right?
That's the only specific questions that were asked and not answered in this case. But they, again, questions were not answered subject to an ALT objection being resolved by a judge. The other problem that you have is that you get a situation where the defense controls what opinions they're going to allow a jury to hear. They can sit down with their witness and say, I like these opinions. These are good opinions. I'm not going to raise an ALT objection to that. But these are bad opinions, and I'm going to raise an ALT objection to those opinions. Or in a situation where, for example, in a medical negligence context, you have four different treating healthcare providers, they can talk to each of the four and say, your opinion's kind of weak. I don't think we want you to testify. I'm going to ask you to raise an ALT privilege. You, on the other hand, you have a good opinion as a negligence. You have a strong opinion. I'm not going to raise an ALT objection there.
Counselor, would you have some problems like you do when someone asserts attorney-client privilege? And then they venture one foot into the relinquishment of the privilege and end up having to testify. So, I mean, shouldn't we treat just the same as any other privilege that counsel argue about at depositions, and then the court will look at whether or not you gave up your privilege by some of the questions you've already answered?
And if that's the case, then in this, by their own admission in their brief, we allowed them to answer all of the opinion questions other than standard of care. If that's the way it's going to be looked at, then the privilege has been waived because they have started to answer opinion questions and they shouldn't be able to pick and choose which opinion questions they're going to address to a jury.
So you'd rather have them answer nothing rather than telling you what they did, what they saw, why they did, what they saw, how they manage the patient. You don't want that. You'd rather have them say, don't say anything at all to me.
Is a party defendant? Absolutely, as a plaintiff's lawyer. If a party defendant is going to take the position, if my choices are I want the party defendant to say nothing and not get up there and defend their conduct, or the party defendant can get up there and express opinions hostile to me, but I can't ask any opinions that I think may be helpful, then yes, I want the party defendant not to testify at all.
Okay.
I have a question. Vera Brocken is the nurse who put together the health care plan?
That's correct.
All right. Okay. Here's the question to her. I'm reading from Respondent Appendix 155. Question is, in order for a nurse who is putting together a care plan, what should that nurse put in the emergency plan as it relates to airway management, oxygen therapy, resuscitation, and ventilatory management in order to meet an accepted standard of care? That was objected to and wasn't answered.
That's correct.
Now, she's putting together the plan. I would assume she would know what a plan is supposed to cover.
That would be my assumption as well.
Otherwise, if she doesn't, I would assume that that might be an indication of negligence.
I would assume that as well.
So you want that question answered?
I want that question answered.
And it's by somebody who is doing a plan, is performing it. Now, would you ask a doctor who performed a surgical procedure? What are the proper procedures in this surgical procedure?
I would think whether in a medical negligence context
or
any context, it's a standard type of question you would ask somebody who was actually involved in the act, which is the subject of the litigation.
What is the standard procedures for this, you name it, appendix removal? And then you'd say, and is that what you did? And he might or she might say, yes. You might say then, are there exceptions to this standard? And were any of these exceptions present here, right?
Again, I think that's just standard questions.
Standard questions. So I've been trying to go through this record to see which ones where you have somebody who is doing something with this patient, why you can't ask that, and what the general rule is.
And let me be clear that all three nurses did something with respect to the patient. Nurse Avery was the nurse who was on duty when this incident happened. Ms. Verbrocken was the one who wrote the health care plan and had been her personal care nurse in advance of the time that Ms. Avery was. Ms. Fontaine did the orientation and the training of the nurses. So in each of these cases, none of these is a situation like Dr. Acosta in Ault, where he was divorced where his conduct was not at all at issue. Dr. Acosta may well have been an employee of a party to that case, but his conduct was never at issue in that case. And he was never being asked questions with respect to an incident in which he had direct involvement in which his conduct was called into question.
Is it your position then that, or your belief that Mr. Schott is asking us to extend the principles of Ault to a situation that was not contemplated by Ault?
That is my belief, and it's partially in response to some of the things Justice Bradley raised about specific language in Ault and the specific concerns about parties trying to dragoon experts who weren't involved in the litigation and bring them in. And again, that's not the situation. We have people who are going to be called as witnesses. I expect will be called by the defense as witnesses, and we just want a chance to ask them opinion questions when they're going to be called as witnesses, particularly in support of the defense case.
You mentioned my writing in Ault, and as I read my interpretation of Ault, seven of us, I gave in my dissent mine, my interpretation of Ault was, since it was based on a statute that had nothing to do with medical experts at all, just the appointment of experts, that the majority opinion as written was not limited to medical malpractice or medical experts. I have two questions. Number one, is your interpretation of Ault the same or different than that?
My interpretation of Ault is that it applies to any individual who may have any degree of expertise beyond that of an ordinary layperson.
And the second question, and I'm looking at your opposing counsel's brief, and I can pull up a number of amicus to illustrate the same point. When at page 4 of the primary brief, no, supplemental brief, I'm sorry, the expert privilege applies to all experts is the heading. Is it your understanding of your opposing counsel's position, and I'll ask him in a moment, that the rationale of Ault applies, that his position, your opposing counsel's position, is that it applies only in medical malpractice, or the Ault expert privilege applies to all experts?
My understanding, and I believe that it's a uniform understanding, is that the Ault privilege applies to anyone with expertise. They may be saying that it is more likely that you would find compelling circumstance in some other cases, but there's no question that everyone is in agreement that the Ault privilege applies to any individual with expertise as that decision is drafted.
So when you were going through the product design engineer and why in the product's liability case he may or she may have done something, Ault privilege, as you understand it, covers that testimony as well as the security officer, supervisor that you were talking about in that laundry list that you went before?
In all of those situations, the Ault privilege applies. And at the the grace of the defense attorney or the grace of the plaintiff's attorney in some cases, that question may be allowed to be answered if they believe there's compelling circumstances. But it's their decision as to whether to assert the privilege, and in any of those circumstances, in any of a number of routine type of cases, you would need to either make a determination as to whether it's important enough that you're going to go compel that testimony and take a second deposition or follow-up deposition, or whether it's the value of the case or the information makes it not worth it for you to do that.
Assuming that we accept the compelling circumstances test, is there any reason why we couldn't read compelling circumstances to include a specialized knowledge of the case?
I think that certainly the court can do that within the power to define the ALT rule, is to say that, look, what we intended to do by ALT is to not have people who have no particular specialized knowledge of the circumstance was at issue in the lawsuit dragged into the case by one of the litigants for whatever reason. But if somebody has specialized knowledge of the circumstances which this lawsuit arose under, then their testimony, expert testimony, can be compelled. And again, saying their expert testimony can be compelled isn't saying we're compelling you to give an expert opinion. It's saying we're going to bring you in there and ask you these questions, which in many cases the response may be, again, particularly something specialized like this, I would really need to review literature, review all the medical records, and review depositions to give you an opinion. I'm sorry, I just don't have an opinion on that. But we're entitled to ask those questions when somebody has that type of specialized knowledge.
Is that the same as saying ALT doesn't apply to parties and their agents?
I would say that there's two different ways to look at it. The first way is simply to say, as a rule, ALT, the privilege, does not apply to parties or their agents. The second way to say is the privilege is uniform. It applies to anyone who has expertise, but as a matter of law, it's a special circumstance or a compelling circumstance when the person providing testimony is a party defendant, party plaintiff.
But it winds up the same place.
It winds up in the exact same place.
When a witness, when you want to ask a witness a question that requires an expert opinion, do you have to qualify that person as an expert?
I think that you don't. If I am examining these individuals, I don't think that I necessarily need to qualify them. I think that Mr. Schott certainly could interject a foundation objection, and that would be handled as it is in discovery. They would probably be allowed to testify notwithstanding the objection, and it would be taken up with the court before trial. So certainly if the objection is that these people shouldn't even be testifying in this area, then the proper objection isn't the ALT privilege, the proper, because they probably have no opinion or no competent opinion, the proper objection is an objection to foundation. And we're certainly not suggesting that those objections can't be made.
Counselor, if you get an answer back, as you think you might, that these witnesses have no opinion because they'd have to review literature to determine what is the generalized standard of care throughout the country for this particular type of question that you're asking. And say you get that answer and you present that to the jury, how is the answer to that question relevant to whether or not they violated what was the proper standard of care?
Well, one thing it does is it protects us from any testimony coming at trial that may be in conflict with that.
That wasn't my question. My question was, how is the answer to your question relevant to the question of whether the nurse violated the standard of care? She tells you she'd have to do research to give you an opinion on what is the standard of care over for a reasonable nurse in reasonable circumstance. How is her answer to that question relevant to whether she violated it or not?
I think, for example, as Justice Abrams suggested, that if the nurse who was in charge of writing the care plan were to say, gee, I really don't know what the standard of care is, I don't really know what I'm supposed to put into a care plan, that may very well be relevant as to her negligence in purporting to author a care plan when she really didn't know what items should be in the care plan. I think that similarly could apply to a nurse who provided treatment. If she really had no idea of what was the proper way to conduct treatment under these circumstances.
But now, you go way beyond what I ask you. I just really want to focus on the standard of care because that's what's bothering me here because that's what was objected to here. I personally am not very good about taking hypotheticals that aren't before me too far because it's difficult to know what parameters they may have. But I'm very concerned, and I thought some of your answers were quite good, about why you needed this standard of care answer. And you thought the answer was going to be they wouldn't know. Well, then when I got to thinking about that, I'm thinking if that's the answer you think you're going to get and you're precluded from getting, okay, so say I let you get it. I don't see how it's relevant to whether she violated the standard.
And it may well be that as a result of motions in limine or something, the trial court determines that it's not relevant. But we don't know that the answer is going to be I don't know. We're entitled to the chance that they're going to express some opinion. If it's I don't know, it may be irrelevant for the reasons that you've advocated or you've set forth, or it may be relevant because it may show that by not knowing the standard of care, that made it less likely that they followed the standard of care. If they didn't know what...
Well, you still have to have someone establish what it is to show they didn't follow it, correct? Well,
absolutely. If they say, I don't know what the standard of care is, we don't win on negligence or we don't win on any issue. We still have to retain somebody or find somebody who is going to be able to give a competent opinion as to what the standard of care is under the
circumstances. So you're still going to have to find an expert?
If they say that they are unaware what the standard of care is, yes, it's going to be necessary to find an expert to opine on standard of care. And I expect that that will be done in this case.
Okay. Thank you.
I look at the people in the hearing room. If everyone here was a nurse, do you think you ought to be able to ask every person here what the standard of care is? And wouldn't that depend, frankly, on how articulate they are in enunciating what it was and even remembering what it was?
And I see my time has run out. May I answer
yes,
Justice
may,
Prosser's question?
Yes, you may, Counsel.
If all of these individuals were nurses that were agents or employees of the defendant and had some knowledge of these circumstances, yes, I think I would have the ability to go through, again, subject to a motion to quash or a motion that this was unduly burdensome, and ask them those questions. If these were just 50 people who had graduated from the UW Nursing School and had no specific contact with the case, no, then I think it would be highly inappropriate that we just go pick people without connection to the litigation and ask them opinion questions.
Unless they're experts.
Unless they're...
No, I think he meant that they were all acquainted with the discussion in the case. So you could ask, you want to be able to ask everybody that's involved a standard of care question.
I want to be able...
There are 10 or 25, and then you'll pick the person that you decide is going to give an answer that you wanted to hear.
I don't want to be precluded by the alt privilege from asking them that question. I may well be precluded by other discovery limitations that may be put on me by the court, but I think that just as if there were 50 witnesses to a traffic accident, I would have the right to question each of those 50 witnesses about what they observed.
Well, yes, but as to the standard of care of how the person was driving?
Did you think he was driving too fast? I think I could ask every witness that. Now, again, that doesn't mean that at some point somebody raises an objection and say, no, this is unduly burdensome. No, you know, we're going to limit the number of depositions you can take in this case. But I don't think the alt privilege should prevent me from questioning. The alt privilege prevents me from questioning any of them. I mean, it applies either to any of them or all 50 of them.
Doesn't the alt privilege just apply to expert witnesses? It doesn't apply to lay opinion.
No, it doesn't apply to lay opinion, but it applies to any opinion testimony offered by somebody with expertise. It doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor, a lawyer, or accountant. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Schott. We have rebuttal time. Mr. Schott, does ALT apply to non-Med-Mal cases?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
Okay. So we have agreement, at least that.
We have agreement on that.
And as you said, and it's not just standard of care, it's any why did you take the temperature? I thought she might have a fever. Any opinion question of any expert in any area. It initially applies.
Implicates the question of whether that witness right. should be forced to answer the question. I want to go back because a number of the questions came up during the colloquy. Well, isn't it relevant to find out whether or not this person knows what the standard of care is? And it's important to think about that question. The answer to that question is that no witness ever knows what the standard of care is, because the standard of care is not a fact. Whether or not the standard of care requires somebody to have in a health care plan information about ventilation treatment and so forth is not a fact. It is an opinion. There's no book that you can go look it up in. There's no course you can go to find out about that. It is various people's opinions. And what happens is various experts come in and give opinions. In my opinion, the standard of care in this circumstance requires this. Somebody else will come in and testify. In my opinion, the standard of care in this circumstance requires something else. And then ultimately, it is a conclusion that the jury must draw as to whether or not there has been a violation of the standard of care under certain circumstances. So if you think about it analytically, no witness can ever be asked the question, what is the standard of care, because it is an opinion question. And no witness can ever can be accused of not knowing what the standard of care is, because no witness can ever know what the standard of care is.
What question do you ask an expert witness, a physician?
You ask two questions. Mr. Witness, Ms. Witness, do you have an opinion as to what the standard of care is in this circumstance? Typically, the answer would be, yes, I do have an opinion. What is that opinion? That opinion is. And it always is phrased in terms of an opinion. And that's what the standard of care is.
So had these questions been, do you have an opinion as to the standard of care for making up a care plan, you would not have objected?
I would have objected.
Okay. Why?
Because that is... It calls for an expert opinion, and there is nothing unique about this witness's ability to answer that question. That question can be asked of anybody that has a sufficient knowledge to know what degree of skill, care, and judgment a reasonable home health care nurse would exercise under the same or similar circumstances.
Well, if you ask Ms. Avery, what is, in your opinion, the standard of care for somebody who has, and let's just assume that this was a high blood pressure case. What's your standard of care for somebody who has a high blood pressure and now is choking? Would that be okay?
Not if phrased in, what is the standard of care?
I asked you about opinion as to the standard of care. Do you have an opinion as to the standard of care?
That would be...
Same question. I'm just putting in your opinion.
I would still object to that question because, once again, it calls for their expertise, their expert opinion, and there is nothing unique about Kathy Avery's ability to answer that question. What is the standard of care? She is not judged on whether or not she met her own personal standard of care. The standard of care is not something that will depend on the very person. It is something that the jury ultimately determines based on the evidence given to the jury by the expert testimony of a number of expert witnesses, what they believe the standard of care is.
Counsel, just this past week there was an article in the Civil Trial Journal on Alt versus Klein and Glenn versus Plant, and then in July there was another article in the Wisconsin Law Journal, and I see next month there's going to be a seminar which includes discussion of Alt versus Klein, and I see that the State Bar has appointed a committee, has funded a committee chaired by Attorney Marie Stanton of Madison to study the Alt issue with an eye towards proposing a new rule or legislation needed to remediate the Alt interpretations. The committee, in addition to Attorney Stanton, would consist of Attorney Pat Dunphy of Milwaukee, Attorney Terry Johnson of Milwaukee, and Professor Dan Blinka. Do you know what the status of the committee's
work is with regard to a new rule or legislation needed to remediate the ALT interpretations?
No, I'm sorry, I do not, Your Honor. Because I've run out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Schott, and thank you, Mr. Beard, for at least our third recent foray into expert medical testimony, including ALT and PLANT and now this. We appreciate that. We now close our hearing on 03-1801, Amanda Carney-Hayes versus Northwest Wisconsin Home Care, Inc. We are in recess, and the court will meet the conference room at 1:30. And the students should remain if they want to visit with Justice Wilcox, and other students will be attending that session. We are adjourned.